Good evening to you. Andrew McGregor was absolutely spot on last night when he described the atmosphere here. It is once again electric, with the Berlin Philharmonic back at the Proms. Later this evening, works by three groundbreaking Viennese composers, sets of orchestral pieces by Schoenberg and his pupils Webern and Berg. Before the interval, the most recent work of the evening, Richard Strauss's Four Last Songs, sung by Carita Mattela. And first, the shimmering spiritual journey that is the prelude to Wagner's last music drama, Parsifal. All the works conducted by Sir Simon Rattle.
What do you put when you have these second Viennese school pieces in the second half? You have to put something which is in some way related. And in a way, we decided to put two big bookends. Music written 25 years earlier, music written 30-something years later. And it's very strange because in a way, the most conservative piece is the Strauss Four Last Songs, which was written after the Second World War. And almost the most rhythmically difficult piece of the whole programme is the Wagner Parsifal Prelude, which moves around in a kind of extraordinary haze of mixed rhythms. But there is something suspended in both, something which doesn't touch the ground, which is a very new phenomena in German music. Debussy said he wanted an orchestra without feet, but in a way, Wagner had invented it in Parsifal. And this great last outpouring of Strauss's life, he was able to produce this same sense.
Simon Rattle, well, Guy at Braunstein, who's leader of the Berlin Philharmonic, has taken his place on the platform, the orchestra just tuning. The prelude prepares us for the great journey ahead in Parsifal. We hear the Grail theme, music associated with the idea of faith, and a passage that illustrates the suffering of Amfortas, guardian of the Grail. Music that's had an enormous impact on listeners. The philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche asked if Wagner had ever done anything better. There occurs, he said, in this music, a sublime and extraordinary feeling, a living experience and an event of the soul. So Simon Rattle takes his position on the rostrum to open this prom with the prelude to Act One of Wagner's Parsifal.
Thank you.
The prelude to Act One of Wagner's Parsifal. Sir Simon Rattle conducting the Berlin Philharmonic this Saturday night here at the BBC Proms. Debussy, who wasn't always Wagner's greatest fan, proclaimed the musical beauty of this work is incomparable and bewildering, splendid and strong. Parsifal is one of the loveliest monuments of sound ever raised to the serene glory of music. Well, as John Shea mentioned just before we went live here at the Royal Albert Hall this evening, a reminder, you might want to try out our new extra high quality audio stream running as an experiment, which started yesterday, runs through until the last night of the proms. You'll find it via bbc.co.uk/proms. Do please let us know what you think of it. All feedback very welcome. Wagner once appeared at the Royal Albert Hall. He visited here in May 1877, but we can go one better with the next work on tonight's programme, Richard Strauss's Four Last Songs, given their world premiere in this very building in 1950. Kirsten Flagstadt was the soloist with the Philharmonia, conducted by a man who was the Berlin Phil's principal conductor for more than two decades, Wilhelm Furtwängler. Earlier, Simon Rattle remembered a former friend and colleague of his who died last month and played in that first performance.
I had the privilege to work for years with Felix Koch as leader of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, a beloved musician for all of us. He was on the front desk of the second violins in the Philharmonia after the Second World War. And I remember him telling me what it was like when they turned up one cold morning in the Kingsway Hall in London. And they had four pieces of manuscript in front of them with German titles, but with no composer. They had, as ever, no idea who was going to be there. Furtwängler walked in, Kirsten Flagstadt walked in, and they played first, because they didn't know what order it would end up in, they played first the movement with the violin solo. I will never forget the look on Felix's face when he said what this felt like, that you had the feeling of a real masterpiece in front of your eyes growing up like some enormous flower blossoming.
Well, the order this evening, we're going to start with Frühling, spring, dreams of trees, blue skies, sweet fragrances and birds singing. Then September, when the garden grieves and the cool rain sinks into the flowers as the summer shudders. Beim Schlafengehen, going to sleep, follows, in which the exhausted poet begs that he'll be able to greet the starry night like an exhausted child. And then in the final poem, at sunset, words by Eichendorff this time rather than Hermann Hesse, journey's end approaches. Karatamatala shakes the hand, kisses, in fact, the leader of the Berlin Philharmonic, Simon Rattle, with her to perform the four last songs of Richard Strauss.
Yeah.
Carrot and Matala embraces Sir Simon Raffle after singing those last words of Im Abendrot, the final song set by Strauss in this set. Oh, boundless silent peace, so deep in the sunset, how weary we are of our journeying. Is this perhaps death? Words of Josef von Eichendorff. Before it we heard Frühling, September, and Beim Schlafen gehen. Words by Hermann Hesse. Finnish soprano Carita Mattila recorded the four last songs with the Berlin Philharmonic and Claudio Abbado. I love this orchestra, she says, and feel I've learned so much from the players. It's unforgettable to sing with Abbado, and I'm so happy that the relationship continues under Simon Raffle. Here they come, back onto the platform together, clasping hands. She curtsies, hand to her chest, stands once again, turns now to bow to the audience surrounding her at the Royal Albert Hall, 360 degrees. That's Guy Brownstein, leader of the orchestra, taking his bow. Horn player, and now the brass section on its feet, and the woodwind too, the whole orchestra. This may have been Strauss's last major work, but that doesn't mean it's not fresh and radical in places. The composer Robin Holloway has written tonight's prom programme note, in which he talks of the new transparency and evanescence of the orchestration. The opening of September in particular seems to hover in mid-air. Strauss had always been lord of long, soaring, almost instrumental soprano lines, but they were never so sinuous, graceful, or lissome as here. And the four last songs, concludes Holloway, youth, freshness, and renewal lie alongside experience, nostalgia, and farewell. You can read those programme notes for yourself at bbc.co.uk/proms. Maybe particularly useful during the interval to take a look at the notes for the three works in the second half of tonight's prom. By Schoenberg, Berg and Webern, which are going to be played without a break this evening. Carita Mattila back on the platform once again. She recalls the first time that she sang the four last songs was in Turku in Finland with a very young Sakari Oromo. Turku Philharmonic, fresh from its summer holiday. The orchestra said, totally crushed me with an enormous sound. So did the papers later, saying I had such a small lyric voice, I shouldn't touch these songs. I learned a lot from that experience about how tricky these songs are. Well, now she's regarded as one of the great performers of Strauss's four last songs. With that, she's left the stage. The orchestra followed. Well, from Richard Strauss writing in 1948, we're going to journey back to the first and second decades of the 20th century for part two of tonight's prom. 14 orchestral pieces written by Schoenberg and his students Webern and Berg. During the period those works were composed, Freud was practicing in Vienna and developing his theories of psychoanalysis. For a while, Freud worked closely with Carl Jung, who was developing his own views on the unconscious mind. Between 1914 and 1930, Jung created a remarkable book known as the Red Book, a handwritten manuscript full of rich, painted images. The Red Book remained hidden from public view until late last year, when a facsimile and translation were published for the first time. For the next 20 minutes, we hear from the writer and broadcaster Bedisha, who went to Hampstead in North London to find out more about this artefact. And if you'd like to see some images from the Red Book itself, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3/20 minutes.
If someone had told me that I had a Monday afternoon appointment to talk about psychotherapy and analysis and archetypes and the soul somewhere in leafy Hampstead in a beautiful house, I would be afraid that I'd been called in to discuss deep traumas of my childhood. And in fact, we are not that far away from it, except that what we're talking about today is a great and undiscovered work of philosophy and art and intellectual practice, amongst many other things. It is The Red Book by Carl Jung. It's a beautiful volume which I have in front of me. I'm actually stroking the red leather spine of it right now. Here to talk to me about The Red Book is its editor, a man who's worked for a long time on this project, Professor Sonu Shamdasani, who's also written widely on the history of psychiatry, psychology and the human sciences, and is acting director of the Wellcome Trust Centre for the History of Medicine at University College London. Here to weigh in on the itself weighty Red Book is Bettina Reiber as well. She's an artist, curator and associate lecturer at Central St Martin's College of Art and Design. She's written on aesthetics and Jung. Sonu, first things first, I've talked about The Red Book. Here it is. Tell me what we're looking at here. It's so heavy that we've had to sort of perch it on its own table, and it looks like something out of a kind of legendary mystery. What is The Red Book?
Well, what we have here is a leather facsimile copy of a work called Liber Novus, the new book, which was colloquially known as The Red Book. This is a replica of the leather binding.
It's once beautiful.
He's inlaid with gold.
Oh, hear that creak. The thing is, book lovers everywhere are going to be salivating over this because it's got these enormous cream pages with the titles of the various sections written in kind of blood red. What is The Red Book and how did Carl Jung come to create it?
In the autumn of 1913, Jung comes to realise that he'd lost his soul, that he'd achieved every wealth and happiness and everything he'd striven for, all his childhood ambitions, but it had left him completely empty and meaningless. And he wanted to find out how he'd got lost and to find his way again in life. To undertake this, he turned to his own fantasies. And when the World War broke out, he came to think that a number of his fantasies, which had apocalyptic imagery, were in fact precognitive of that event.
Prophetic images.
Yes, and that led him to relook at all of his materials in a new light and to begin to study to what extent what had happened in his own fantasies coincided in a more general sense with what was happening in the world at large. He then writes a handwritten manuscript of about 1,000 pages. After typing it and editing it, he then began transcribing it into a leather folio volume, which is a facsimile illustrated with historiated initials and his own paintings.
How is it that it took so long for this book to come into publication? Didn't Jung's family want it to be published?
At Jung's death, he left no clear instructions as to what he wanted done with it. When I started researching it in the mid-1990s, I found some transcriptions that Jung had made by some of his colleagues and approached the family. And at that stage, no one living then had actually studied it or indeed read it. And they asked me what I thought about it and then began a process of discussion lasting a couple of years as to what to do with it. Quite simply, once one had actually looked at the materials and seen that this is a work written for publication, this is not a private sex diary or ravings of a lunatic, there became no reason why it shouldn't be published.
Is that what convinced you to argue for its publication, that you felt that there was something here which could illuminate the world of scholarship on Jung's work?
Well, this clearly transforms everything that one had previously come to know about Jung, because suddenly you've got a first-hand text, Jung's own account of the most important period in his life. You can now trace for the first time the steps between his own fantasies, his reflections on them, and his attempt to turn that into a science, which has had tremendous influence in the 20th century in psychotherapy, in popular culture, in the arts, and the humanities at large. It's a work that has had influence without actually itself ever being read, which is a very peculiar situation.
Bettina, how does it feel to encounter this book for the first time?
I think it's a real surprise. I don't think I've seen anything like it. One thinks of medieval manuscripts, but of course it was produced in the 20th century. So the question is, why does Jung choose to, if you like, go back in time? I think it's interesting that the writing style is a particular script, and that is a medieval Gothic, an early Gothic script. So again, Jung would take the trouble, as Sonu explained, from his ordinary handwriting to typewriters, and then, if you like, go back, but I suppose that's the wrong word, he goes forward to handwrite it yet again and goes through all that labour and chooses to do it in a way visually that's reminiscent of the Middle Ages.
Where does this book stand in the context of Jung's thinking and his approach? It's very interesting that he created this in private during a moment of crisis. Sonu talked about these sort of prophetic images he had of, he talks about rivers of blood. He is anticipating the world war.
He's addressing here a reality that goes beyond the ordinary reality that we mostly take for granted, or rather that we engage with, which is ordinarily we think what we can perceive with our senses is real and everything else is sort of a little bit scary maybe. And I think this is the point in Jung's life where he says that he's now going to fully address this, if you like, other or bigger reality. And very much early in his life, he already distinguished his two personas, the number one, which was the schoolboy, and I suppose later the successful psychiatrist and the sort of person that lives in the outside world. But he also always had this number two, a much more eternal, wise person. And I think this is the moment when he fully embraces this number two and seeks really to find what I would call spiritual facts, so that he can then begin to think about those facts and understand them. But first of all, he's got to experience things and put them down.
The Red Book is replete with imagery of all different kinds. There are geometric, highly patterned, very, very decorative images. There is the playfulness when he illustrates the capital letter at the beginning of a new section. There are also what he calls mandalas, sort of schematic images, which he thinks expresses exactly what's going on from the highest element of the human soul right down to its core. How do you think the images and the text in this amazing book fit together? I feel that it's extremely deliberate.
I think that the images and the text interconnect in different ways. Sometimes they're incorporated within the picture, and then there's an obvious clear reference that they're intertwined and they belong to one another. Sometimes they give us a flavour of what is to come. Sometimes we have pages which are text only and there's no imagery at all. I think what's interesting is the references that he makes to all sorts of different cultures, be they Egyptian, just the one that you've opened there.
This is image 55 and 54. 54 is a great snake sort of giving birth to what looks like the tree of life. And then 55 is a wonderful barge with a sea creature lurking underneath it.
That's right. And I think it's quite obvious that, you know, it's symbolic work in that the serpent has very many different meanings in a whole variety of different cultures. The tree of life you've mentioned, again, it's all over the world. The fish, the sea creature, the monster, another one that we can find in a whole range of different cultures. And Jung was very interested in looking at other peoples and other times. He absorbed that material and then it would come up when he was working on his own individual journey. And he would put it down for him to study later as to what the meaning might have been.
Sonu, do you agree with that, that these images are in part a kind of Jungian intuitive working through of his own ideas?
I would rather say that what the book shows is Jung's rediscovery of his own soul, and he finds it through his own fantasies. He doesn't use any technical language, there's no reference to the unconscious or things like this. He doesn't need that. It's rediscovering what is of ultimate value to him. And it's the preciousness of that rediscovering his capacity to live, which is why he does it in this form.
Do you think that something comes out when Jung creates images like this, which he himself wasn't aware of? The reason I say it is because if you look at the way he's depicted landscapes throughout the book, First of all, he starts off being quite literal and being quite realist, and then they seem to become much more symbolic and much more loaded. And then there's another shift back. So clearly something is going on with the images.
That's precisely the key point. As far as he's concerned, as he says, it sometimes took him decades to actually understand what his images were depicting. They were a source of great significance for him precisely for that reason.
Bettina, one of the things one immediately realises looking through the Red Book is the care Jung has taken to produce a work which doesn't just express his ideas, but is also very pleasing and thorough in terms of it being an object, in terms of it being an artwork. If you look at the way he balances the text with this sumptuous imagery he's created, it put me rather in mind of the way William Blake published his poems, richly illustrated. Do you agree?
I think that many people will think of William Blake because he also combined, as you say, text and image, and because he also produced the text himself as well as the imagery and turned that into illuminated books. Equally, Blake had visions as a young person, and he writes these things in contradistinction to the narrowness and the fixity of the industrialization that begins to creep in. So there are parallels there as well. I think, though, that there are also huge differences. I bring in here the Songs of Innocence and of Experience, and although it's not the original, it's actually the original size. Yes. Now, if we compare the sheer volume of one and the other...
Oh, bless. It looks like a huge parent towering over a very small child. The William Blake is less than the span of my very small hand across, and it's this sort of delicate, dusty blue colour. In fact, the atmosphere of William Blake's book is different, isn't it? One of the key approaches of William Blake, but also of Jung in his Red Book, is the way that the eternal, the historic, the dreamlike, the intuitive comes into grating contact with the industrialised, the unnatural, the mechanistic. If we look at one of the largest and most vividly coloured images in the Red Book, image 125 shows an extraordinary combination of things. Bettina, do you think you could describe this? I think it needs a proper art person to do it. If we start off at the bottom, it seems like a sort of a village scene almost, a realist landscape, but it doesn't turn into that.
The page is almost split into a bottom half and a top half, not quite, the top half is a bit larger. And the pictorial language is entirely different. So at the bottom, it's quite the traditional Western European approach to showing perspective and the illusion of space and depth. We very clearly know we are in a particular moment in time. We can see objects like, for instance, a factory, and there's steam coming off the factory chimney. As you mentioned, the industrialization has firmly taken hold. It's almost collecting as many items as possible. We've got a steam ship, and we've also got, which is quite interesting and horrifying, a lot of men with guns, military personnel. And so it is quite gloomy. The whole colouring of it is quite dull and threatening.
It's quite sinister, isn't it? Because the soldiers, who are all in a kind of grey uniform, are doing target practice up a hill. They're in front of what is either a prison or a garrison or some kind of fort. Two of them are standing guard. There's a huge cannon which isn't currently in use, but looks as though it generally is in use. There's a beautiful family house with a fountain, but even that is ring-fenced by a white wall. And all around, there are ugly factories. There's a castle in the distance, which is usually such a romantic image, but here it just looks grey and haunted. And yet, above this scene of slightly unsatisfactory, claustrophobic human life, there's a sort of resplendent... Is it a sun? Is it a ball of flames? There's a godlike, almost like a Shaolin monk type man in a wonderful blue and white striped costume, holding an urn above his head and a flaming, I'll say it's a sun, correct me, Bettina or Sonu, if I'm wrong.
Well, I don't know whether it's a sun, but I'm immediately reminded again of a mandala in that, although it's slightly cut off, but we've got this circular shape and the disc in the middle with a cross across it is reminiscent of certain Christian medieval mandalas or mandala-shaped symbols. And I think for me, this very much shows at the bottom the number one personality, where they have to live, they have to survive in ordinary life. And the pictorial language that Jung assigns for that is perspective and tonality, whereas he moves into a totally different kind of language in the top part, which is flat, very brightly coloured, very dynamic, very animated, very much more positive, a space you would much rather be in than in the bottom half. And it is, as you say, as if this person who sits on the cusp, just on the borderline between the two, is seeking to be maybe nourished by this sun, this nourishing thing, whereas it doesn't really seem to want to go further down.
Sonny, do you agree with this interpretation in this wonderful image of conflicts between the worldly number one personality and the much more idealistic, sublime number two personality?
Well, I personally refrain from speculating about the images, in the sense that what I've done in the notes is I've reconstructed as far as possible Jung's own understanding of them, because the iconography is very particular. But in a broad sense, yes, there is a contrast between the two parts of the image. This is painted in about 1920, and I think an important reference in the lower half, the realistic scene, is it resembles a fantasy which Jung describes in his childhood, where he sees Alsace
submerged underwater and
turned into a port. So that there is a deliberate, to my sense, referent to that childhood fantasy. And yes, it's a military scene. There's a contrast between, this is in 1920, this is 2 years after this most horrific slaughter that's ever been witnessed in Europe at that stage. And it's a contrast with the mandala, the sense of wholeness and resolution, how to fit these two together.
In the course of the Red Book, does he ever actually manage to reconcile these two things? He's grappling with them continuously, both in images and in text.
In a certain sense, he reaches a point of, okay, now he's realised certain things, but he now has to go out and embody them in his life. He now has to take it out into the world. So his confrontation with his own inner world reaches an end, and his confrontation with the world at large, society and politics, begins.
You can see the resplendent colouring of image 125 and some of the other images from the Red Book if you visit our website. If you go to bbc.co.uk/radio3/20minutes, that should take you to it. The book is now undertaking a sort of international glory tour. It's been in Washington, it's due in Paris. What effect do you think it will have on the scholarship of Jung and our understanding of his work?
In terms of the scholarship on Jung, it begins from now, because for the first time you can actually understand Jung's conceptions from their base. This is the main text from which it all came. You have a first person voice of Jung depicting, this is what happened to him, this is his own experience. So whether you agree with it or not, that's inconsequential. You can actually see the experiences upon which they're built up, and the steps from his fantasies, his reflections upon them, and his attempt to mine that for a universal science of psychology. And in that sense, I think it's possibly unique in the field of the history of psychology that you have such documentation that you can follow all of those steps.
Bettina, how do you think that it will go on to affect our understanding, not only of the philosophy of Jung, but also mixing philosophy and the book as artwork?
Well, I think the, for me, really interesting piece about the work is that it taps into a problem that we have today, which is that we more or less only give credence to things which we can scientifically evaluate in the very traditional way. And here I think we find something where somebody finds totally different form of expression to allow his unconscious to well up, and then manages to reintegrate that into a scientific language, and therefore reassures us all that maybe we could all open up to that bigger reality. And ultimately, I think this has been an ongoing debate within the art practices, the different art forms, as well as in philosophy. So I think it's an incredibly interesting but also quite unique approach by anybody to externalize what they have within themselves in this particular form. And I think that's why it's a very special thing to have.
The artist Bettina Reiber ending that discussion on Jung's Red Book. The presenter was Padisha, and she was joined by the editor of the book as well, Professor Sonu Shamdasani. The programme was produced in Manchester by Nick Holmes. Well, back here at the Proms, we're about to journey to Vienna. Freud may have declared that he could get no pleasure out of music, but his home city was alive with the art form in the first years of the last century. Tonight, Simon Rattle conducts the Berlin Philharmonic in works by Schoenberg and his students, Webern and Berg.
I think there is something about Vienna which produces great art. It's not always to do with Vienna as a place, because normally whatever art has been going on at that particular moment, Vienna has been fighting tooth and nail against. But there is no doubt that if anybody interested in the arts wanted to be around in any place at a particular time, that the 10 years or so before the First World War, my God, was that a time to be there. All the different forms of art, poetry, painting, music, theatre, you name it, everything was exploding.
Well, we're going to hear first a work given its world premiere at the Proms in 1912 by Henry Wood, Schoenberg's five orchestral pieces, concentrated, highly emotional music predating his invention of serialism. Schoenberg was writing in 1909, as was Anton Webern, who created a series of six pieces for orchestra, inspired by the death of his mother a few years earlier. And finally come Berg's three orchestral pieces, written after Schoenberg told him to abandon a symphony he was writing and instead create a set of character pieces.
This should be a very, very powerful program together. It's kind of a triptych of three painters who are related, but absolutely dissimilar, and I really tried to decide as we talk whether we really play them as one piece or whether we play them as three separate pieces. My feeling is that they tell a real story together, but as we talk, we're rehearsing them. We're very excited and we're sweating blood, to be honest. Still, 100 years later, they're really hard to play, but there is no doubt that they are some of the greatest, most emotionally involving, and most sheerly, sensuously beautiful music ever written.
Well, since that interview, Simon Rattle has decided that he's going to play the works in one arc of music, as he's going to announce himself from the stage, Berlin Philharmonic back in position, tuned, and awaiting his arrival. And here he comes. Music ahead by Schoenberg, Webern and Berg, Sir Simon Rattle conducting the Berlin Philharmonic.
When we were rehearsing these extraordinary masterpieces last week, it became more and more obvious that they belonged all together. And we decided that then we would play them without pause, like a kind of triptych, or maybe like an imaginary 11th symphony of Gustav Mahler, or 17th. So, with this in mind, we would ask you not to applaud in between, but if you feel like it at the end, a little encouragement would be fine.
Berg's three orchestral pieces. Before it, Webern's six pieces for orchestra. And we heard first Schoenberg's five orchestral pieces. Sir Simon Rattle conducting the Berlin Philharmonic here at the BBC Proms. Henry Wood, Sir Henry Wood, as he'd just become, conducted the Schoenberg at the 1912 Proms. It received its world premiere. His musicians a little confused by the piece. "This is nothing to what you'll have to play in 25 years' time," Wood told them. Rattle back on the platform, bringing his orchestra to its feet. Earlier he described these three works and these three composers as being rather like a triptych of three painters, Klimt, Schiller and Kandinsky. Schoenberg himself, drew so much from the ideals of the Expressionist painters, painted himself when crisis meant he was unable to compose. Wonderful picture, in fact, of Alban Berg with the portrait of him painted by Schoenberg in tonight's Proms programme. Great pictures of Webern together with Berg and Schoenberg as well. You can see them at the Proms website, bbc.co.uk/proms. Webern writing his pieces after the death of his mother. The third movement reminded him of the moment he lay a flower on her coffin. The fourth recording his feelings when he walked behind her in the funeral procession. Alban Berg studied for four intensive years with Schoenberg and dedicated the score of his three orchestral pieces to his master. Not that their relationship was always easy. The satirist and comedian John Bird, with me in a Proms Plus Royal College of Music earlier on this evening, talking about how Berg was horrified when he discovered Schoenberg was moving back to Vienna. Schoenberg reckoned his student was just too louche in his life. So having brought section by section to their feet, Simon Rattle back on the rostrum, shaking hands with Guy Brownstein, leader of the Berlin Philharmonic. Rather touching moment at the beginning of the rehearsal this afternoon when the orchestra bade farewell to Armin Brunner. Last night was his last ever concert with the Berlin Phil. He's been a violinist with the orchestra for 40 years, retiring now to live in the Swiss mountains. Rattle gave him a big hug after last night's concert. How amazing to have played in this orchestra for 40 years. What he must have seen, playing for 20 years in the Philharmonie on the edge of the Berlin Wall, and then 20 years after the wall came down. Berlin Philharmonic's appearance at the Proms has been made possible with assistance from Deutsche Bank. Simon Rattle back centre stage again. Well, we've two Proms for you tomorrow here at the Royal Albert Hall. 2:30 will be recreating the last night of the Proms as it was back in 1910. It's a free Prom, the seats are gone, but do come and Prom if you're in central London. Come along and join us, or listen here on Radio 3. Paul Daniel will be in the role of Henry Wood. And then at 7:30, Henry Wood Day continues with the Ulster Orchestra and Paul Watkins performing Bach's, Liszt, Sibelius and Rachmaninoff's first piano concerto with Stephen Osborne as soloist. Both those concerts available to listen to on our new high-quality, extra-high-quality audio stream, Proms website, bbc.co.uk/proms. Well, the Berlin Philharmonic leaving the platform now. The hall will empty soon. From us here at the Royal Albert Hall, good night. Back to John Shea at Broadcasting House.
That was Petrarch Trelawney at the Royal Albert Hall. You can hear tonight's concert again on Radio 3 on Friday afternoon from 2:20. Or, of course, at a time of your choosing on the iPlayer. You'll find the link to that via the Radio 3 website, as ever. And if you are investigating the iPlayer, then you can also use it to watch tonight's concert. Television coverage is happening at this very moment on BBC Two, I believe. And it should be available shortly after that ends, in about an hour and a half from now. Well, as Petrox just told us, there are two live Proms tomorrow at 2:30. And in fact, the evening one begins a little later than usual at 8:00. And that late start for the main evening concert means that Drama on Three begins earlier than usual at 6:30 tomorrow. And tomorrow night's play takes us to 1950s Paris for the devastating story of a passionate love triangle. Damian Lewis heads the cast in James Baldwin's modern classic, Giovanni's room.
Until I die, I will hear the exact timbre of his voice. See his face in all its changes.
And did you mention me at all? Did you say you were sorry, but you had a girl in Spain? Did you wish I was there?
When I looked at him, at the way he was that night, with all the light of that gloomy tunnel trapped around his head, they stormed all over me.
What?
My awakening. My insistent possibilities. So, that was how I met Giovanni.
The first radio adaptation of a landmark American novel. Damian Lewis and Greta Scacchi star in Giovanni's Room. That's Drama on Three, tomorrow night on Radio 3, beginning at 6:30. Well, we've drama next this evening in The Wire. That follows in a minute or so. Then we've contemporary music from this year's Spitalfields Festival, when Ivan Hewitt presents Here and Now at 10:30. So before The Wire, a little more Rachmaninoff piano music, played by Stephen Osborne. From Rachmaninoff's Opus 32 set of preludes, that was number 6 in F minor, played by Stephen Osborne. And he'll be appearing in tomorrow night's prom with the Ulster Orchestra, conductor Paul Watkins, playing Rachmaninoff's first piano concerto. That prom tomorrow night begins at 8 o'clock. This is BBC Radio 3. It's now just gone 9:45, and we've another chance to hear a play from our drama series The Wire. Lucy Island is written by one of Britain's most promising new playwrights, Laura Lomas. It's set in and around Matlock in Derbyshire and concerns a sometimes disturbing rite of passage undergone by a young woman who's trying to come to terms with grief. The play contains strong language.
It's 10:35, September 12th, and this is my final message. I'm sat in a shed with my feet hanging out the doorway. Caravan's burning bright. Tonight is the night they've been waiting for. Tonight, they'll light up the sky with fire and smoke. Sail huge floats down the Derwent, full of colours and people with smiles full of teeth. That the sky won't light up because of the clouds, except the floats won't sail because the rivers run dry. Tonight is our anniversary. It's been 1 year to the day that my dad hung himself with a rope. We found him in our caravan. His lips were blue and cold as ice when we got there. One burn the bastard thing tonight. Doused it all in petrol, struck a match and watched it burst. She was sobbing when it went up. I told her I was sorry. She'll miss me when I'm gone. My name is Lucy Island. And this is how the river ran dry.
What?
I need the loo. Can I come in? Loo.
Mom?
What?
I'm in the bath.
So?
You can't just walk in.
What, do you want me to piss myself?
I'm naked.
Oh, grow up. It's nothing I haven't seen before, is it? And don't roll your eyes at me.
I didn't.
I just saw you.
Oh, God.
Don't look at me then, will you?
Can you get out now?
I need to do my makeup.
Where are you going?
Swan.
Again?
I work there.
Yeah, not tonight.
You'd rather I stayed in on my own, would you?
No, she'd be grateful, shouldn't I?
You should get out of that bath now. Water will be freezing.
I'm not ready.
You've been in here 50 minutes.
Yeah, I wanted a bath.
Here, put this round you, catch a chill.
Who are you meeting?
No one.
Him that was here this morning.
What?
I heard you. Is he nice?
It's nothing to do with you.
Well, it is when you come here with it, isn't it?
I'll be back late.
I won't be here.
You're not sleeping in that caravan again?
I can do.
You're not?
I can do what I want.
I'll burn it loose. I'm not kidding you. You're not staying there.
You wouldn't.
Should have torched the bastard thing months ago.
I wouldn't let you.
You couldn't stop me, Luce. I'd douse the bastard in petrol and set a match to it. Have a bonfire on the hilltop, eh, Lucy? Would you like that?
Yeah, you'd have to burn me too. What?
What's that?
What?
On your face?
Nothing.
There is? There! Jesus!
It doesn't matter.
Someone's had a go at you.
No. No.
They have. Lucy! Who's done that?
No one. I fell over.
Lucy!
I fell over.
Come here!
No.
Lucy!
Oh, don't touch me! I'll see you later.
Where are you going?
Thought you'd come here.
You've been waiting for me.
No.
I bet you have. I bet you've been sat up here all afternoon waiting, thinking, where's Lucy? When's she gonna be here? I miss her. Have you?
Piss off.
Don't worry, I've missed you too. I brought some wine. I nicked it off my mum. Do you want some?
Heard about what happened with you and Vicky?
I don't want to talk about it.
You just tried to strangle her, did you?
No.
Gonna expel you?
I said I don't want to talk about it. How's it coming?
It's all right.
It's getting quite big now, isn't it? Do you reckon it'll be finished soon?
Might be.
Are you going to tell me what it is?
I told you no, you'll have to wait.
I'm bored of waiting.
Well, you're always bored of everything.
It's going to rain.
Maybe.
Look at it, I can tell. The sky looks like it's going to burst. Up here, you know. It's my favourite place, I reckon. You can see all of everything, can't you? The quarry, the river. Do you know what I mean?
Not really.
Do you reckon if you gobbed on someone from this high up, it would kill him?
Don't be stupid.
It's all the same colour up here.
Not even the fields. All the same colour. I reckon we should leave, you know. Just pack up. I wish I could. It's too much greyness. Don't you think?
You're being weird today.
I'm not.
Yeah, you are loose a bit.
How am I being weird? That shirt now.
What's wrong with it?
Nothing.
It looks all right.
Where did you get it?
Town.
Can you take it back?
It's from the surplus store. It's proper, it's veteran, still got the label.
It's a bit big.
It's not.
It is. It looks stupid.
Piss off.
I'm just saying.
Well, did I ask you to? Yeah. No, I didn't ask you, did I?
Yeah, no, but...
Yeah, well then, you can shut up. No, I should go.
David.
What?
I only just got here.
Look, it's late and I probably need to.
No, just don't go, David. I'm sorry, I just...
No, it's time yeah, and...
But you haven't finished your thing yet, have you? Look, what you're making. I could help you with it. You need better tools. I got some. We could get them. I could get you them from my van. I've got all sorts. Hammers, drills.
No, it's getting late. My dad don't want to see me.
No, see him later.
I can't.
Why not?
But he's going out. He's got friends to see, so...
I'll come back with you then. No, please. I don't want to go home. We can stay at yours.
No. No, you can't.
David.
I'll see you tomorrow.
David! Look, I didn't mean it about your shirt. I think it's nice.
Tomorrow. I made you a sandwich.
I'm not hungry.
No, fish fingers. Want no ketchup, but we have brown sauce.
I don't want it.
You eating today, Dad? Don't ignore me, you've got to eat. Been out? Can you hear me? Eat your sandwich. Eat it, Dad. I made it for you. Eat it.
What are you doing?
Eat it.
Give me that back, David.
Look, for me, Dad. Will you eat it for me?
Give it.
I'm asking you. Please.
Give me the bloody thing back!
Right, look, shh. It's all right. Okay, I'll clear it, okay? It's okay. I'll clear it.
I told you not to sleep in here. Can you hear me?
What time is it?
Don't worry about the time, Lucy. Are you listening to me?
What?
I told you not to sleep in the bloody caravan. Don't you look at me like that. Have you seen it? It's like a bloody quagmire, Lucy. It reeks. Can you smell it? God. Sit up.
What do you want?
Sit up now, Lucy.
I'm tired.
Sit up before I drag you out that bed by your hair. School's been on the phone. Yeah. Don't sigh at me and look at me in the eye when I talk to you.
You don't understand.
Spot on, Lucy. I don't. I ain't got a bloody clue no more.
You weren't there. You didn't see what she was doing.
I heard you tried to strangle her. I heard it took three of them to restrain you.
She was saying stuff.
Was she?
Saying all sorts. She wouldn't shut up, kept going on and on in my face, laughing at me, all of them.
So you smacked her?
Yeah.
Tried to kill her?
You never heard what she said about Dad.
Tell me. Go on, Lucy, if it's upset you that much. Tell me, I'm all ears. Your dad ain't here no more.
Mum.
No, Lucy, you hear this. Look at this place. It's like a shrine to him. It's sick. I should burn it all.
No.
He ain't here no more, Lucy. He left us.
Mum.
He did, Luce. He made his choice. He didn't even give a second thought about us, me or you. He left, and he left a massive trail of shit behind him. He couldn't even help himself, could he?
Oh, I can't do this, not now. Get dressed.
Where are we going?
You're going into school.
No, I can't go in, Mum.
I don't know what to do with you no more, Luce.
Don't make me, please, please, please.
Tell me what to do.
Please.
Oh, don't get upset again. I can't cope with you, Luce.
I'm fine.
Please.
I'm not crying.
You do this to yourself. Do you know that? You do it to yourself.
I'm not crying, I'm not.
I can't stay out that late.
Yeah, I know.
I mean it, Lucy.
I know, I heard you.
All right.
Yeah, but you can stay a bit.
You know that...
Yeah, you're always running off.
My dad'll be waiting.
I thought you said he goes out.
He does. Just not tonight.
Yeah, well, you can go, can't you, once I've found these tools.
This is your dad's caravan.
Yeah.
Is that him there?
Yeah.
You look like him.
I think it's near here, him. It's got everything you'll need, isn't it?
This.
You can't have that.
Who was that?
It don't matter.
Look, Luce.
What?
Wait, 1 minute.
I'm looking for your tools.
Lucy.
That's what we've come here for.
Lucy.
What?
I need to talk to you. It's about Vicky. No, listen, it's important.
I told you I don't want to talk about it.
Right, I heard she was after you. Now, they'd hurt you, them two. You know they would.
I don't care.
You would do, her and Amy.
No, I couldn't give a shit about either of them.
You all right?
I'm fine.
What did they do? You can tell me.
You want to know? You really want to know?
Luce,
they brought a rope for me. They were laughing, told me to put it around my neck. Tried to take photos of me on their phones. Tried to hold me down and draw black tears on my face with a marker. Is that what you wanted to know?
Don't cry.
I'm not.
You got tears, Luce.
I'm not. I'm not crying.
Please, don't.
I'm not.
Cry. Oh, God. Should I get you a tissue?
No. What?
Luce.
I'm not crying, David. You tell anyone I'm crying and I'll smack you.
No, I won't.
I mean it, David.
No, I know. I know. In the army, if you don't drink water or anything, your whole body dries up. Yeah, you can't piss or sweat or cry or nothing. Or your skin cracks, like a massive scab. It happened to someone, my dad told me. I've seen pictures. Not lying, I googled it.
What are you on about?
I don't know.
Will you stay here? Just for a bit.
Bloody hell! What you done, Dad?
I was cooking.
It's all right.
I was trying to make some pasta.
It don't matter.
It's all black.
Shit, Dad, you left the flame on. So why didn't you ask me?
You weren't here, David.
You could have called me, you know.
I don't need to call you to make some pasta, do I?
Well, I could have come back.
I can make pasta.
Did you add water?
What?
Did you put water in the pan?
What?
You have to put water in the pan when you make pasta, Dad.
Of course I put water in the pan.
It doesn't look like
I put water in the pan, David. I put water in it.
It looks like you just
I can remember how to make a sodding pot of pasta.
I think we should go out for a bit, yeah?
No.
Well, the house thinks of smoke.
It's raining.
Yeah, it's always raining.
I'll go out when it stops.
It's not bad.
I'm not going out in it, David.
It's bad for you, staying in.
I'm not going out in the rain, David. I'll get wet.
I thought you didn't care about that stuff. You didn't used to care before.
No.
You stay here like this.
No.
Like you're never going to leave again, Dad.
I will.
That you stay here like you've gone mad.
No. Ah!
Dad?
I'm at my chest.
Shall I call a doctor?
No, I'm fine.
You're not?
It's just asthma.
It's not.
It's just.
Ah! Dad? Right, I'm going to call an ambulance. Dad?
The only one to talk to, yeah? It's only a word. She was nice, the woman, when I spoke to her. She made me a cup of tea. Just where you was. Get your head out of the water, Lucy. You'll drown yourself. Lucy? Lucy?
Christ! What are you doing?
Oh.
Are you alright?
I'm fine.
Did you hear what I said? It's just one word, Luce. Just a sorry. Just a sorry and you can go back. That's all they want from you. Lucy?
What are you doing here?
Can I come in?
No.
Please?
You wake my dad up.
What is important?
He's resting.
You were supposed to meet me.
I'm sorry.
I only want to talk to you.
I can't, Lucy. I'm sorry. What?
Let us in.
I said no.
I need to talk to you.
You can't come in.
I know what you're making. It's a boat, isn't it? Am I right?
Lucy.
David?
Who was that?
No one.
Just let us in. 5 minutes.
I can't.
What's happened?
I can't see you no more, Lucy.
Why?
Sorry.
What? Why? Why not?